This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 80 was released on September 14th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to our listeners in Florida, the Caribbean Islands, and everywhere else that has been affected by Hurricane Irma. Please know that our thoughts are with you and your families. Macro investing legend and manager of Eclectica Hedge Fund, Hugh Hendry, will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the general economic outlook, why quantitative easing didn't produce the massive inflation that so many people predicted, and why Hugh now sees a major inflation on the horizon, even in the face of central banks unwinding their easing programs. We'll also discuss precious metals, China, and a whole lot more. And you're really going to be blown away by the prediction Hugh makes at the end of the interview about his own industry, global macro hedge funds. This has to be one of our best interviews to date, folks. I think you're going to really enjoy it. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank each and every person who has donated to help us defray our production costs. We received our first $500 donation this week, and we continue to receive numerous $100 donations. Please know that every donation in any amount is appreciated and helps us to continue bringing you the very best content that we can every single week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 broke out to all-time new highs this week. What's your feeling about the markets here?
Well, the first thing that I should mention, Patrick, is that we are recording today's market wrap at noon on Thursday, as opposed to our usual recording time at the close. So this discussion will not include anything that happened on Thursday afternoon. But you know, the S&P 500 took a nosedive this morning on reports that North Korea was actually in the process of launching an ICBM, that they were fueling it and so forth, getting ready to launch what could be a nuclear ICBM. That tanked the market, and sure enough, it has fully retraced and broken out to another all-time high in over the course of the morning. So, you know, what's a little ICBM threat between friends, I guess. As much as I do think this is crazy, and I do think the market is overvalued, you know, it's probably not over yet. We are at a new all-time high here, just as I speak, around noon on Thursday. If you listen to the interview with Hugh Hendry, he sees the market continuing higher, and as much as I don't agree with the valuations, I don't see reason to think it's going to crash. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I did buy puts on the S&P this week, but I'll be the first to admit it's not because I'm convinced the market's going to crash. It's because there's a possibility. And frankly, I think of this as an antidote trade. It overcomes my emotional desire to short this market, which I know is a bad idea. So my guess is those S&P puts will probably expire worthless as this crazy market marches even higher. Someday this is going to end very poorly for the stock market, but it seems like that downside reversal is not in the cards quite yet.
Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index next. What's your thinking about what's next for the dollar here?
Well, it looks like the dollar index bottomed, for now at least, at 91. We're above 92.5 now on Thursday afternoon, as a lot of technicians are saying 91, they believe, was the bottom. You got to be careful calling tops and bottoms in markets like this, but a lot of people are saying that they think it's the bottom and a major move higher is afoot. And of course, the CPI data this morning certainly helped that. We're looking at nearly record low inflation numbers. Be sure to stay tuned for the feature interview with Hugh Hendry, though. He's got quite a lot to say on inflation. Personally, I am looking for an opportunity if we were to get all the way down to 87.50, which is that next major support level on the dollar index. It's actually a little above that, 87.55 or so. I would buy that because I'm convinced that it's good at least for a bounce there. But, you know, would it be a tactical trade or would it be a strategic buy to hold it, expecting it to go back over 100? I haven't decided yet. I am seeing more and more good arguments to persuade me that maybe there's another side that I had not considered to the secular bullish view that I have held. Hugh Hendry's view definitely influenced my thinking. I don't want to steal his thunder, but stay tuned and you'll see that Hugh has changed his tune from what he had to say about the U.S. dollar last time he was interviewed on this program.
Now let's move on to crude oil. Now the hurricanes must be influencing these inventory numbers. What's your thinking on oil here?
Well, as I've said before, Patrick, inventory should not matter because the system is just thrown out of kilter with the hurricanes and all of the disruptions that have occurred, and the inventory numbers don't really have their usual meaning as far as I'm concerned. With that disclaimer in place, crude oil built 5.9 million barrels. Not surprising with refineries offline, meaning that oil cannot be consumed. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1 million barrels. Gasoline, record drawdown of 8.4 million barrels. Now, a lot of people are really hanging their hat on this and saying, holy cow, what's going on? Record drawdown in gasoline. Look, you know, we just had two really crazy hurricanes with refineries offline and everything else. It should come as no surprise to anyone that we had a record drawdown in gasoline. It's transitory. It's not going to be the beginning of a trend. It's a result of these storms. Distillates, meanwhile, drawing down 3.2 million barrels. Remember, though, that there are still, I don't know what the number is now, at one point there was more than 30 million barrels of oil in ships still waiting to get into port. A lot of those ships have now gotten into port, so the number's less, but there's still a big overhang of crude oil waiting to get into port. That's going to drive potentially more builds in inventory in coming weeks. U.S. production rebounding exactly as I predicted it would. We're not quite back to 9.5 million barrels. We're up 572,000 barrels to 9.35 million. As of this week's EIA inventory report. Now, looking forward from here, I still have a bearish view as to where we're headed with oil prices later in the fall. But if you look at the tape action in the last couple of days, we saw a clear upside violation of the trend line that was in play. That starts to paint a picture maybe of a bullish cup and handle formation that could take us up to 52 or 53 before it rolls over. Now, I think that what's going on here is that with the inventory data clouded by the storms and so forth and not having its usual meaning, that leaves more room for people to be wronger for longer. In other words, if people have a bullish view that's based on data, and I was expecting inventory builds that are seasonal to prove that wrong and turn the market around to the downside, well, that's not going to happen quite as soon as I thought because of all of the crazy stuff going on with the hurricanes and so forth. The other thing that I would point out that's a possibility for why this could be a false breakout to the upside. We do have options expiration in the crude oil market tomorrow, and the largest open interest is at the $50 strike. That may explain why the options market makers are trying to game the price toward $50, as opposed to I thought it was going to roll over and move back down to the downside below $49. On the other hand, another concern to the upside is the Brent WTI spread. That's the premium for Brent crude oil, as opposed to West Texas Intermediate, has really blown out to very, very wide numbers, around $6. So if that means that was driven by the hurricanes and it has to come back together, either Brent has to go dramatically down or WTI has to go up in order to catch up with Brent. So that puts more upward pressure, at least in the short term, on WTI crude oil. So my view is definitely evolving to a very distinct possibility that the turn to the downside in prices that I thought was imminent may actually be delayed, and we might be looking at a move up to 52 or 53. And finally, a rumor which may be influencing all of this is that Saudi Aramco has suggested that they may wait until 2019 before the IPO of Saudi Aramco. Now, of course, a lot of people were speculating that rumor came out as supposedly coming from someone familiar with the matter, and then there was a denial that came out of Saudi Arabia afterwards. So we don't really know what's going on there, but that may be playing a role in the prices here. I think we have to wait to get through options expiration, which is Friday, and see what happens to the price on Monday. But unless it takes a really abrupt turn to the downside, I think that probably what's in the cards is this move will continue up towards 52 or 53, and at that point we'll get a rollover and lower prices in the low 40s, if not lower, by the time we get to Christmas.
So now let's move on to gold. What's your thinking here about the next move in the prices of gold here?
Well, Patrick, I'm loving this weakness in the gold market. We're down to 1329 as I speak, and we touched 1320 earlier today. The reason I say I'm loving the weakness is because I think that I'm probably late to this trade. I should have bought it a while ago, and I'm waiting for a good, healthy pullback. If we get down to 1300, I'll probably buy some, and certainly if we get to 1280, I think that's an excellent entry point to go long gold here. I did ask Hugh Hendry about this, as you'll hear in the feature interview, and he has some comments on the subject as well.
And finally, what is your feeling about these 10-year treasury yields? Where do you think the interest rates are heading now?
Well, we're back up to 2.19 on Thursday afternoon. So it looks like the breakdown below that critical support level at 2.12 didn't hold after all. Maybe it was a false breakdown. Of course, some of the things that are going on with the stock market and nuclear missile threats and so forth may have something to do with it. In any case, I think that Hugh Hendry's insights are going to really fascinate our listeners. He has a lot to say about the bond market, so I'm going to leave it there and save the rest for Hugh Hendry.
Thanks for the market wrap, Eric. For this week's featured interview, we continue our fall all-star lineup with Hugh Hendry from Eclectica Asset Management. Eric's interview with Hugh is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Hugh Hendry, manager of the Eclectica Hedge Fund. Hugh, last time you were on the program, several people on Wall Street were starting to say that the market was overdue for a correction or outright bear market. But you very confidently assured us that things were better than feared, and so far you've been absolutely right in that call. But now the chorus of doomsayers has grown much larger. Jeff Gundlach has been extremely outspoken, saying he's going to make at least 400% on his S&P puts. Quite a few pundits have suggested that the business cycle is long overdue for a recession. Analogies to 2000 and 2007 are everywhere you look. Even Goldman Sachs chief Lloyd Blankfein recently commented publicly that asset prices have gone up too much for too long. So, Hugh, is the growing chorus of bears about to be proven right, or do you think that this global economy still has room to grow and markets have room to march even higher?
Well, I guess it won't surprise many that I probably find myself in what feels like a little bit uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable from the vantage point of managing a macro portfolio to say that I still believe the system is healing. And yes, I certainly accept that valuations are high, but I can't really see anything to get in the way, if you will. Now, you mentioned corrections. One can never really dismiss that they are an ever-present with us in financial markets. But in terms of calling an end to proceedings and looking for a correction greater than 20%, or indeed 20% drawdowns in the S&P are rare, like hen's teeth, but something severe and something of the order of what we saw, of course, in 2008 and 8 years previously. I want to say I just don't see the setup for that situation presently.
Now, before we move on to what you do see going on in today's economy, I want to talk about how we got as far as we have without seeing any inflation. Because when the Fed announced QE in 2009, a whole bunch of people were convinced that it was going to cause massive crushing inflation. So far, that inflation has never come. So how is that possible? How do we get through so much money printing out of thin air injected into the economy without wage and price inflation ensuing?
Well, indeed. And who knows? I can merely sketch out, hopefully not too pithy comments, but to my mind, the core of the response to your question is really that that liquidity, this immense volume of money that was created in the first order by central banks, it was distributed to the very rich. I mean, I've been at pains to present papers on the role of the global creditor in the last 4 decades have been a magnificently rewarding period for the global creditor, the people who supply the capital to our hardworking entrepreneurs in our economy who go on and create jobs and income for all of us. Those creditors, for many decades, had actually enjoyed this kind of very high real rate of return on lending money to others. And then, of course, with the advent of quantitative easing, they found themselves receiving this immense distribution from central banks. And the problem is that these rich folk, if you will, they have a very low monetary velocity, which is to say they don't, their impulse or their marginal desire to consume that wealth is really, really very low. So at the margin, we gave dollars to people who really didn't have the inclination to spend money. And therefore, this injection, this great largesse, came to be stored rather than multiplied by the fractional reserve banking system. You know, true money creation is when people say, hey, you know, give me a loan, I feel good. And then we start the banking system, if you will, almost creates money out of thin air. So it was never, it was distributed, if you will, to the wrong folk. And then in the years that passed, if we turn our attention back, what, 4 years ago to what's come to be known as the taper tantrum, I mean, we saw a Fed which pronounced a desire and an intention to start reining back quantitative easing. So to tighten, if you will, but I think the Fed's intention had been to be tentative and slow and cautious, but nevertheless to tighten when we had a national unemployment rate in America of 7.6% and really no indication of excess in terms of wages and cost push items, which can generate nasty inflation. So really quite a hawkish intention by the Federal Reserve. And then it was greeted, if you will, by the monkey mind of the capital markets. And the capital markets, is the tantrum notion is, we saw a huge sell-off in 10-year US government bonds, and yields went up to 3% at the 10-year level. And so we saw this immediate tightening. And of course, the aftermath of that has been the tightening was unwarranted. The economy wasn't firing on all cylinders. We saw, a well-placed bear market in oil. And then, of course, we've had these, what I like to refer as these ghosts in the machine, these great paranoias. I think the most notable of the 2015 vintage would have been this great fear of a significant devaluation in the Chinese renminbi. And of course, these were fears which so far have not materialized, but I would like to say that the combination of all of those events inevitably led to this grind lower in the price inflation series that we see today.
Now, the reason that I wanted to start by understanding how we got this far without serious inflation is that while the bears are all drawing parallels to 2000 and 2007, you told me off the air that you actually see a closer similarity between today and 1965. Now, first of all, I haven't heard anybody else make that connection. But it seems to me, too, that 1965 was just before the start of an utterly massive wage and price inflation cycle. So are you predicting a return to inflation in the next several years? And what is going to change, I guess, is the real question. How is it that we didn't have any inflation after this massive money printing, and now you see that it is coming even as the QE programs are being wound down? Help me understand that.
Well, indeed. So, of course, we have to go back almost to the Ice Age, I mean, the 1960s. But you're right in your assertion that after the events of 1965, and we'll try and explore them. But for 16 years, inflation rose. We didn't see inflation below 2% for 16 years. It took another 17 years to bottom out. So 1965 is worth consideration. And I'm speaking to you, and we are in the midst of the aftermath, if you will, of this dramatic hurricane, Hurricane Irma, the largest Atlantic hurricane in a century. And again, it just shows you, I'm very close to it because I'm very fortunate in that I have a property in the very beautiful island of St. Barts. And so the last 5 or 6 days have been rather traumatic watching events. But when I think of it, there's another cycle. There's been a building boom. And when I think of the beautiful villas on that island, nothing predates really. The last big one, which was 1993, and really the one behind that was Hurricane Ivan in 1988, these are just so long ago that they have been either forgotten, dismissed, or that we are inured to the devastation that can be brought on. So let's go back. Why 1964-65? And I have to say the reason is because you had pretty much all the same signals from the labor market. Unemployment was below 4.5%. Now, I must preface that and say that we had, of course, two periods before that. We had 2005 and back in 2000, in the height of the TMT bubble, when again we had a national unemployment level which was 4.5% or tighter. But those two latter events were economic periods which were, if you will, they were ripe for a correction in economic momentum. You know, we had bubbles. We had a misallocation of resources within the American economy with regard to, of course, residential property in the latter years of 2004, 5, and 6, and previously in telecoms and technology. And therefore, interest rates and the Fed tightening actually had an immense impact in taking away any incipient inflation. But 1964, 65 is relevant, and I think it's relevant today because I think one of the big analytical errors that people may be making is that we have to recognize that recessions do not come out of thin air. It's not like you set your watch or your calendar and you say it's 4 or 5 years or 6 years and it's long overdue. Recessions emanate from a vulnerability with regard to the errors of all of us in getting too excited about particular areas and overinvesting, if you will. And therefore, we are potentially compromised when you see a Fed come in and begin a tightening cycle. And so I would contend, and it's contentious to say, but I would contend that barring these unforeseen black swan events, there is just nothing of the magnitude of credit excess within our economies today, which makes it vulnerable. And secondly, I'd say that capital markets, macro hedge funds, but really the managers of real money, these big, huge pools of pension funds money, have largely given up and they've come alongside the Federal Reserve. They've stopped berating the looseness of monetary policy. And now everyone is resigned to the notion that inflation is structurally low and the only response can be looseness in policy. So there, if you will, there are no agitators for tightness. And back in 1964, as I say, the figures, it just looks like today, you know. And again, if we look at today, you know, the unemployment rate below 4.5 is very low. Job openings, they're very high. The quit ratio is very high, which is to say, you know, those in jobs are now feeling confident enough to say, well, hey, look, if you don't give me a pay rise, I'm going to cross the street and join the competition. The hiring rate hasn't increased as much. And therefore, to my mind, but you've got a pot and it's bubbling and I can hear the lid begin to rattle somewhat. But my point is, yes, I'm drawing comparison with regard to these levels. Again, if with full transparency, there's one statistic, the level of unemployment for those actively seeking jobs, you know, those, if you will, between, I don't know, the ages of 20 and 64, if you will, we're not quite at the lows that we saw in 64, 65. But the thing that the true linkage is that there aren't the credit excesses and therefore the vulnerability. And there really is no group strong enough to agitate that we should be hiking now and taking that risk off the table. Because when we look at wage or this cost push inflation, I think the experience of that time suggests it's immensely difficult to contain, far harder than containing asset price inflation. And therefore, it brings to mind the comparison of how Hemingway described going broke. You know, it was slow. It was, you almost didn't have any sense of it. And then it was devastatingly quick. And there's no one in our community that's willing to say, hey, listen, I don't want to underwrite this devastatingly quick phenomenon. So that's, if you will, I'm simply trying to be a provocateur. And I'm trying to say there was a big hurricane and it feels like it's offshore just now. And when these things come onshore, you know, really, are you prepared for it?
So I just want to be clear. You're making an analogy to the economic conditions that existed in 64 and 65. Are you necessarily forecasting that that massive wave of inflation that came in the late 60s and early 70s is coming? Or are you merely saying it's something we should be watching for because we have, you know, the ingredients, the barometric pressure says it's possible a storm could arise? Do you see the storm coming in on the radar, or are you just concerned it's hurricane season?
I concerned it's hurricane season, the various measurements we have, if you will, the atmospheric pressure of the US labor market and the lack, if you will. So let's bring the metaphor full forward. The sea temperature in the Caribbean, etc., has been very high. And that's what powers the devastating force of a hurricane. And for me, the sea temperature, my analogy is with the lack of resistance. No one now believes that we should be preemptive and hawkish. Everyone is saying, let it pass. You know, I don't want to take the extra mile. Now, what I want to say to you is I've tried and tried and tried to withdraw myself from this kind of role of being a prognosticator, like a soothsayer, to tell you what is going to happen in the future. I've always struggled with that concept. Yes, we have these brilliant minds, but until we invent a time machine, no one can see the future. And I find it's pathetic for me to sit here and say, there's going to be this high inflation in 2019. Instead, I see my role as an architect, and I have clients. It is my duty of care to build structures that can withstand even the most intense things that nature can throw at us at a reasonable cost. So yes, you could insure a building to withstand damage, but of course, what's your budget? And so really, I'm kind of excited today because with this huge consensus, I can, if you will, as my architect role, I can defend my properties from even something as severe as 1964-65. But if you will, I'm like Noah. I'm saying to you, where are the Noahs in our community? Now, you mentioned Gundlach, who might even be on in the same sentence. So Jeff's got S&P options and realized volatility and the implied volatility and indeed the spread between those two. They're low, which is to say the price of that hurricane insurance is cheap. But we get into these price regimes with equity volatility. It trends and it continues just to feed on itself and trend. And so buying equity volatility or buying these puts just because they're cheap has never really worked as a viable technique, I believe, to insuring portfolios. And then finally, I speak too much, but the big concern that I have is that our system, our financial system, your wealth today is subject to the defense of your managers having really quite a large allocation to 10-year treasuries. For the last four decades, whenever we've had a correction or a more severe rout in stocks, those treasuries have gone the other way, which is to say that they've gone up, they've made you money, and they've made the damage less. Today, if I was an architect, I would not be using the building blocks of U.S. treasuries to defend my wealth.
Now, the last time that I interviewed you, you were decidedly bullish on the U.S. dollar on a secular level. But the inflation that began in the late 60s also marked a period of great dollar weakness that led to the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in August of 71, when President Nixon famously slammed the gold window. So does this new view of yours about inflation mean that you've reversed your outlook for the U.S. dollar from bullish to bearish? Or is there a different view? Help us understand how you now see the U.S. dollar.
Okay. So again, with full transparency, I have endured a very, very unpleasant, or my clients, if you will, but you know, I count myself alongside them, a very, very unpleasant summer. And yet, in the sense I've lost money, if you will. And yet, nothing has gone wrong. I've found myself in this terribly uncomfortable position where my risk book has become correlated to the maelstrom, which is the presidency of Donald Trump, and of course these news bombs that emanate, of course, from the Korean Peninsula, and no pun intended. Now you're right; the dollar has had in the order now of about at least 12, if not more, percent in terms of a drawdown. Now I've had exposure to that. My exposure, however, has been limited. Indeed, my narrative is limited exclusively to the dollar-yen rate. I have been running a long dollar position versus the Japanese yen. And the reason for that is, I hope, is consistent with what I've been saying, in that I think what we're going to see, if any of my feelings about that labor market in 1964-65 has relevance in terms of where this labor market is going to take us, then I think we're going to see a great fight between market and managed prices. As you know, the Japanese authorities are intent on maintaining the price or the price fix on 10-year Japanese government bonds, whereas, of course, in other G7 and across the world, our government bond prices are really determined and dictated by the free market sector. And so, if you will, the catalyst being that at some point we cross this Rubicon and we start seeing more sustained and higher US wage gains, if you will, which feeds through into higher inflation, then the Fed will raise rates. Now, the shock, if you will, the shock, what would be a new thing is higher interest rates failing to induce a recession. Don't forget, the great minds presently, the Fed has rates of just over 1%, and markets are telling the Fed in terms of the flattening, this dramatic flattening in the US yield curve, that's the yield differential between 2-year and 10-year, the market is telling the Fed that rates at 1% are going to slam the economy into a recession. That's what the market is saying today. I think the market is wrong in that. I don't think we see any evidence of that. And I'm willing to bet that we could get to 2% rates or 3% rates, and it will fail to induce a recession. Now, why is that? It's because if we see sustained wage increases, then you end up squaring the circle. Because what was the problem that we said about QE initially? The problem was you gave liquidity to folk who didn't have any desire to spend it. When you turn that on its head, when via wage price gains, you give marginal dollars, you're giving marginal dollars to people who want to spend the money. And so you get a lot closer to the conjecture of the helicopter money that Chairman Bernanke promised back in 2002, but subsequent central bankers, not just in America, but elsewhere, they dared not distribute it. We get into that point. And so I think the economy could actually prove to be far more robust in the face of higher interest rates. Companies will continue to employ staff. Wages will be increasing, which is to say that totality corporate revenues will be holding up, probably rising, if they can achieve productivity. Activity gains. It's a big if, but if they can, profitability will remain reasonable. And so I think it's safe to say that those corporations will commit to pay staff more and they'll raise their prices to cover these incremental wage costs and higher interest rates. So the shock, to my mind, could be Fed at 3% rates and an economy which is not tanking, if you will. Now, if that comes to pass and the Bank of Japan is still maintaining JGB nominal 10-year yields at zero, then we're into a world where dollar yen has to trade at 120, 130, and keep adding 10 increments as you move into that environment.
But it sounds like that outlook really is a dollar yen outlook. It's not so much a secular dollar is going to be strong against everything. It's really a more specific trade as opposed to a dollar outlook. Is that right?
It is. You're right. You saw through me immediately by I'm shirking your question. In general dollar terms, I have to say right here, right now, I can't see much in the way of impetus apart from it being oversold. But I can't see much in the way of impetus for anyone to be immensely bullish the general basket of the US dollar against other currencies.
Okay, great. Now let's move on and translate this outlook to what it means for the bond market. We still have some prominent people. Our mutual friend Raoul Paul is predicting 50 basis points on the 10-year at some point, expecting that we're going to continue to see a big move down in yields. With inflation on the horizon, I assume that you're envisioning higher bond yields secularly over time. So give us your overall forecast, including how the yield curve would evolve in the outlook that you have.
Well, I think I intimated to you that the yield curve is just way too flat, that the yield curve is saying that present Federal Reserve official rates will induce a recession. And I believe that that is Raoul's view, that a recession is coming. As I say, my retort to that is that they don't come out of thin air, that it is the presence of higher interest rates, which festers, if you will, upon a misallocation of resources within the real economy. And the fact is, the real economy has been okay, but it hasn't been red hot, and entrepreneurs haven't gone crazy. Yes, like high-end real estate is expensive. You know, there are pockets of expense, but I believe that they owe more to, you know, circumstances such as, you know, the pool of savings out of emerging markets being able to invest in the US. So really my point today is I find it very hard to dissuade anyone not to invest in, if you will, the permanent portfolio. A permanent portfolio construct would be a quarter of your assets in treasuries, a quarter of your assets in the S&P, a quarter in the dollar, and a quarter in precious metals. But for that matter, just let's call that commodities. My view is that I think the S&P will continue to glide higher. I think there's probably more money. I think I could envisage a world where actually European markets could actually stretch out and try and reclaim the highs that we saw back in 2000. Now, if that's the case, you're talking 40, 50% upside in those markets. And I say that because, you know, the click, the change this year is that we are in the midst of a synchronized global economic expansion, as we haven't been able to say that for a long, long time, 10 years or more. So I think equities are glide path, which is still higher. For all of my reservations about the treasury market, I just don't see it cracking. Commodities, they've already told you the world is subject now to synchronized economic expansion. Industrial commodity prices have jumped higher. I think they're now on an upward path like equities. And then the dollar, stale money, if you will. But as a construct, I think you'll find that the majority of active macro portfolios today will struggle to beat a permanent portfolio composition. Now, personally, I wouldn't recommend that because I don't like those treasuries. And I don't like them because 10-year treasuries today look like a very, very expensive zero growth equity. Okay, so let's think of it. I accept, even with my claims that we're okay, equities are expensive. So why would I want to put a 25% allocation into another equity-like product, which is expensive and has no prospect of growth? You're, if you will, you're simply doubling up on the risks of owning what are expensive assets. So in the short term, for the next, if you will, 18 months, I just think this pot of tepid water is just, the temperature is going to keep rising and the existing trends are going to be reinforced. And that the only flaw in the thinking just now is the over-reliance on G7 sovereign bonds to diversify and protect portfolios. That's my concern.
I want to come back to equities in just a couple of minutes, but first I want to talk about a couple of trades here, because you mentioned to me off the air that your team at Eclectica is working on a trade that involves a curve steepener on the MOVE Index. Now, as I understand it, the MOVE Index is basically the VIX for the bond market. It's a measure of volatility in the treasury bond market. So please explain the concept behind this trade. Why do you see a better opportunity to trade vol in bond markets as opposed to the yields themselves?
Well, I'm showboating. I find myself in an environment where I have to try and impress other people, if you will. This is me. I'm a magpie with a shiny coin, putting it in my nest, if you will. Why? I think I gave mention to Gundlach and his S&P puts, and the notion that equity volatility is low. Fixed income volatility, of course, is also low. The data is sketchy, but I don't think it's been lower than this for three decades. I employ people in my business, and for all of their lifetime, fixed income volatility has never been as low as it is today. And when I look at correlations, if again, with Jeff and his S&P puts, he's long volatility. And when you look at correlations, you need negative correlation, which is to say you need the underlying asset, that is the S&P, to fall, to go down a lot to make money. That is not the case with being long fixed income volatility presently, when you look at the models of how it reacts and how the price moves around. So I like that because I have huge reservations about treasuries, but like most things, I really just cannot foresee this Fed changing its spots, if you will, and becoming an activist and saying, hey, we're going to take off that risk that we're in a 1964-65 scenario. This Fed, and again, as we mentioned with the dollar, this Fed is going to just keep itself kind of uncontentious, and it's not going to try and bring on a slowdown in the US economy. So I think bonds are just kind of just going to sit there being ugly, ugly as anything, but not doing anything. So I don't want to have an asset or a bet, a speculation today, which is dependent on a crash in that instrument over the next 12 months. And so I think fixed income volatility is low. It doesn't have the same trending characteristics as equity. And we're now at levels which are reminiscent of the eve of the crisis of 2008, where the price is so low that to really get it wrong, you have to see a further cascading in fixed income volatility to lose money. Now, again, if I try and be smart, I think yield curves are going to steepen at some point. And so when I look, I could put on a yield curve steepening vol trade. There was an expectation that the Fed would be hiking rates further into year end. That has dissipated over the summer. As the prospect of the Fed being more proactive has receded, what you find is that the price volatility, the uncertainty and the convexity has been bid up, which is to say that two-year Treasury fixed income options are expensive, whereas reassuringly, 10-year still cheap. So I kind of want to pay 10-year volatility and I want to receive two-year Treasury volatility, which is to say I think I want two-year price volatility to fall, and I can conceive of 10-year price volatility going up a lot. So, I mean, I would pass over that to many respects. You know, it's my job. My job is, in some respects, is complexity. This is a complex trade, and it's designed to recognize the environment that we might find ourselves in for the next 12 to 18 months of becalmed Treasury prices. You know, they have no real yield. These are securities which are priced to make you nothing. They're a great redistributor of income. You know, they are redistributing income from wealthy folk who own them for a fear factor. And they're setting up an environment where we might stoke up a great bout of wage price inflation from the labor market. So maybe we should encourage that. I would say to you that perhaps at the end of the day, quantitative easing will end up doing what it was always supposed to do in the first place. Quantitative easing was a system which was designed to increase, not decrease interest rates. It was designed to create a robust and growing economy. And that growth would come via higher wages. And those higher wages and your reasonable levels of profitability would be able to deal with the burden of higher interest rates. So higher interest rates will be the success, the triumph of quantitative easing.
So if I can just summarize that to make sure I got it straight, if you look at this market, even though you are very quick to say you think there is room for more growth, you would stay long the stock market. At the same time, you acknowledge nothing is cheap. Valuations all over the place are just very expensive. And if what you want to do is buy something that's ridiculously cheap, the one thing that you can find is this very complex differential trade, which is essentially being long 10-year volatility, short 2-year volatility, because you see an imbalance there. And that's basically the only place you can find anything that is ridiculously cheap. Is that a fair assessment?
You got it. You got it.
Perfect. Okay, let's move on to a subject which is definitely of interest to a lot of our listeners, near and dear to their hearts, which is precious metals. Now, you're seeing both increasing inflation and increasing interest rates. And of course, increasing inflation is very good for gold, increasing interest rates not so much, unless the inflation is outpacing the interest rate. So what do you see on the horizon for precious metals in this scenario that you envision?
For me, I've had a personal journey with precious metals. When I set the macro fund up 15 years ago at the end of this month, I set that fund up with the explicit intention to have a mandate wide enough which would allow me to invest in precious metals, in gold in particular. And so I was fired up. I had an immense imagination about the events that were going to come and take the gold price higher. And I was very fortunate that they came to pass. I'm kind of, if you will, I bought gold when I was a naive teenager, and now I feel like I'm a grumpy pensioner 15 years later. So capital markets do to you. And I just find my passions can't be stirred in the way that they used to with precious metals. Now, that having been said, I would not dissuade anyone to own precious metals just now. Would I make a distinction between precious metals and other commodities? Not really. Not really. I don't think precious metals will defend a portfolio under the scenarios that I describe. But I think for those scenarios to come true, we'll probably be creating an environment over the next 18 months, 24 months, which will be positive for precious metals. And of course, we all kind of look at the hothouse of price charts, and it's reassuring that precious metals have had a big and a protracted bear market. And the bottom around $1,300 has been tested many times now, and it would seem that it's held. And if you will, this seems to be the notion of a triangle in terms of if we tabulate this sort of this long drawn out bear market in gold, which has been 5-6 years. The portents are that it's shifting gear and perhaps we might be entering into the Klondike of a rising trend. So I'm apathetic. The attraction of gold, if you will, is that at least it's had a severe 50% correction, and it's been on its ass for 5 years. And contrast that with the S&P, which has only had, 10 to 12% periodic corrections. So, but I see them as the same. I mean, when I go around my permanent portfolio, treasuries just look like a really, really expensive zero growth equity. Equities look expensive, but are trending higher. And we just really can't see anything sensible about the valuation of gold. It is what other people are willing to pay. What we can see is that it looks as if it now wants to trend higher for a while. So yeah, why not?
Let's come back to equity, since you mentioned those a couple of times. I know you don't hold equities in your fund because your mandate is to offer your clients diversification from equities. But obviously, you think about this a lot. So setting your own holdings aside, what do you see ahead for global equity markets, not just the U.S., but around the world? And particularly, how would you favor any markets over others? Is there parts of the world that you see as stronger or weaker than others?
Well, forgive me, because I feel that I've answered that. You know, I think if we go back in the commentary, I suggested that European equities. Europe survived a great challenge. A challenge this year with populism at its peak, or what seems to be a peak, with the successful election of Macron. And it survived a very tardy, if you will, response from the European Central Bank for many years. But the reality is, the central bank got there belatedly in January 2015 in terms of quantitative easing. And so for the last over 2 years now, Europe has been subject to the appropriate looseness of monetary policy. And European economies are now rising, and perhaps we'll begin to reflect that populism may be reversing. Let's hope so. I can't say, but I can't really see anything to get in the way of Europe continuing to move forward. And if that's the case, then why not? Why can't Europe reclaim the lost ground from the highs of the year 2000? I mean, that's 17 years ago. So, but for all of these gains, remember, we're talking about nominal price changes in stock markets. And in nominal terms, Europe has been better this year. But when you adjust for currencies, well, it's just the other way around. Europe looks as if it's been poor. But when you adjust for the weakness of the dollar, it's been a splendid investment for American investors. So I think really, the great frustration for me is that the implications of sustained global economic growth, you know, they're good for others. It's good because it underwrites positive performance in stocks. And I'm saying I would stay low. But it's bad news for folk like me, because we're required to demonstrate negative correlation with stocks. So when they go up, guess what? We don't. And as you said, on that risk underwriting, all of our clients have equities. So even if I think equities are a great bet, I really can't invest in it. But I'll get off my soapbox, and I think we'll move on.
Well, another topic that we discussed last time you were on the program is this massive credit expansion in China. Quite a few notable people, including Kyle Bass, have been very outspoken in saying that the Chinese credit house of cards has to come crashing down sooner or later. It's only a matter of time before PBOC will be forced to devalue the yuan dramatically, send a wave of deflation around the world, crippling markets, so on and so forth. You've heard the story. When we spoke last time, you were very confident that that was not going to happen. You thought those concerns were misplaced, and to your credit, you've been exactly right so far. But also, since the last time we've spoken, that credit expansion has continued. I mean, the amount of credit expansion that has occurred in China since 2009 is staggering. So do you continue to hold the same view? Do you have any concerns? Do you think it eventually has to bust? Or can China grow through this with maybe the inflation that you see on the horizon?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm of the same views as that I previously offered. Now, I was saying this notion that, you know, people forget, especially in this ghost in the machine, which is the recurring angst that the American economy is going to endure a recession. You know, my point is, recessions don't come out of thin air. They come out of the excess of credit supply if you will, in the real economy. So I don't see that in America, but to Kyle's point, it's a very, very relevant point. The omens, when we look around and we draw conclusions for previous great setbacks at the economic level, it's always at the core has been following a massive and sustained bout of credit creation. So China is rightly very much at the top of relevant things that could go wrong. It's just that it hasn't gone wrong. And I'm afraid I really begin to think it's necessary to pull rope away from the guys that every single year say, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. It's like, I'm sorry, but you're not employed to be the boy who called wolf. You're employed to be the intelligence system which told you within a relevant period of 18 months that there was a wolf in the pack. And so, as we know, our other magnificently intelligent, and brave and fearless Texan investor Mark Hart, a great friend of Kyle's I know, has eventually accepted that reality and has changed his tune. So what could Kyle be missing? First of all, a lot of that debt and that credit creation has been a function of these ugly creatures, these state-owned enterprises and their very basic industries. This year, when we look at prices from copper to iron ore, if it was an X factor contestant, you would have to say that given the price movements in commodity prices, they just don't look like a source of renewed angst or fear. Okay, so the only other area of credit and certainly a lot of debt is the property market. Now, within the property market, only 10% of sales in a year are tier one. Tier one, I'd largely forget about. Tier one is just billionaire paradise. It's not property. It's a very, very expensive safety deposit box. Another 30% of sales, tier two cities, if you will. And they're not billionaires, but pretty insulated. There's a lot of savings underlying those investments. So the big Canadian in the coal mine has been the tier three cities. That's where we had this immense, I mean, the Chinese property market is just this 12-headed, insane dragon, if you will, that's immensely difficult to control. And all of that excess really is from these tier three cities. And a year ago when we were having discussions, it was really, really scary. Excess properties, the inventory of excess properties was something like 40 months of supply. And you know, this accounts for the majority of the Chinese property market, 60% of the property market. But the reality is these are incredibly low-cost housing units. It was never about affordability versus incomes for the folk who could live there. It was about the excess capacity. And the thing that has changed has been the relaxation in the internal passport system that I won't try and pronounce it, which has, if you will, just addressed the supply issue by creating a new source of demand. So by liberalizing these internal passports, more people are permitted to live in these cities. And that inventory cycle has gone from absolute violet get out of the room signals to, I think we're down to about 17, 18 months, which is certainly more typical for the nature of that market. So I want to roll the dice again, and I want to say in 12 months' time that we will not have seen any devastating correction in the Chinese economy or indeed its currency. In fact, if we look at events recently, we've had steps taken by the PBOC where actually, if anything, you know, because as you know, the Chinese renminbi has been a very strong currency this year, and the Chinese are now saying, we're kind of cool with this, and we're so kind of chilled, if you will, that at the margin, they're now paring back the emergency capital walls. So I think, I maintain that the Chinese currency at these levels just seems very, very solid.
Now, speaking of Kyle Bass and that trade in China in particular, Kyle was interviewed last week by our mutual friend Grant Williams, and Kyle posed a question for you, which was essentially, if you were in his shoes as a macro fund manager, in that situation of having a very strong conviction about a negative carry trade that's taking longer than you expected to turn profitable for you, how do you deal with that as a macro fund manager? Now, as tempting as it might be for me to front run our friends over at Real Vision and ask you that question myself, I'm not going to do that because Grant's a good friend and and I would never do that to him. What I do want to do is let our listeners know that we're going to have to cut this short here because we're already at our time budget. But if you want to hear Hugh's answer to that question, as well as a whole bunch of other questions posed to him by Grant Williams, be sure to tune in to our friends over at Adventures in Finance. Their podcast this Thursday evening will also be featuring Hugh as their featured interview guest. Grant will be asking him that question and a whole bunch more. So Hugh, since I can't ask you that question on this show as a courtesy to Grant, I'm going to turn it around to you. Is there anything else on your mind that you'd like to add before we close about the current market or anything else that you're thinking about?
I think I will I will end with another lament. I think we're in the death throes of the global macro hedge fund entity, if you will. I want to say that the global macro model just looks as if it's broken, and I question whether it can be sustained. The global macro model had been a function of sustained and high real rates of return from 10-year treasuries, and one could leverage that return given the sample liquidity, and you would make, the carry would be, in risk-adjusted terms, just pure oxygen, if you will. It would afford you to carry you the expenses of running a hedge fund group. It would afford you to run the expenses of running regulation. And it would afford you periodically to buy what can be expensive options, and typically options like Jeff is referring to on the S&P. And so if there was ever a correction or a crash like 2008, it just added to the bounty, if you will, of global macro funds. Today, I think quantitative easing really has succeeded in killing the global macro community with a 0.3% real return. Even leveraging US treasuries really doesn't seem a sensible course. And it just doesn't leave enough to cover the costs of running small pools of capital in the global macro area. So I can foresee a storm in perhaps 18, 24 months, which will be made all the more worse because treasuries will not defend risk books. And I fear that we might look back and say, where were all the macro hedge funds?
You know, Hugh, I have to tell you, I have always just been struck by your shocking honesty. It gives me so much respect for you personally. And, you know, to close an interview by reflecting so honestly that you see a major risk to the viability of your own business is so out of character for Wall Street guys. You know, everybody's always talking their own book and doing everything they can to try to look good regardless of the actual circumstances. And your consistent honesty just blows me away. So it's a real honor for me to interview you. I hope that you're wrong about that and that your business flourishes and things change in the global macro hedge fund world. But I tremendously just salute your honesty in being so candid about it. We're going to have to wrap it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Hugh. He is so personable and such a pleasure to listen to. His honesty about the challenges that the industry faces was just an eye-opener. What did you take away from the interview?
You know, I have always had an immense respect for Hugh Hendry's candor and honesty. He was so outspoken. I mean, literally confronting Nobel laureates on television and giving them a schooling about how things work in the real world, and then coming out very publicly and saying, you know, I got it wrong. I was the one who was wrong. And his bravery and honesty in admitting his mistakes never ceases to amaze me. He's just an amazing man. Do want to clarify something for the benefit of our listeners who might have been confused. We'd hoped to get this episode out on Tuesday. We recorded the interview with Hugh on Tuesday, and then we ran into some production snags because of Patrick's travel schedule. So you probably will be hearing this on Thursday evening. You will still be able to tune in later. It'll be this evening, Thursday, as opposed to this coming Thursday, as I said earlier, if you want to hear Grant Williams' interview with Hugh Hendry, which I'm sure will be interesting as well. You know, the thing I really found interesting, though, Patrick, is the trend that we're starting to see. Hugh was one of the most outspoken dollar secular bulls in the last interview we did with him. Now, he's still long the dollar versus the yen, but it's come to a trade against the yen. This is very similar to what we heard from Juliet de Klerk. You know, people that used to be dollar bulls are coming around to being dollar bears. And, of course, Luke Grohman made a very good argument last week. Did you pick up on that? And what are your thoughts on the dollar vis-a-vis this interview?
Well, Eric, you know what really kind of comes to my mind is I kind of reflect back as how this whole cycle played out. I mean, go back to our episodes when we started the year and we were having guest after guest that was essentially U.S. dollar bullish. And suddenly, now that the U.S. dollar trend has become so pronounced, you now have a scenario where a lot of our guests that are coming on the show are actually quite bearish the U.S. dollar. Maybe Hugh wasn't outright bearish, but there we are getting a stream of guests coming in that are generally U.S. dollar bearish. And my thought about this is that, you know, I look back at that whole Time Magazine curse, this idea that once something becomes the big trend or it makes it to the cover of magazines, and I'm wondering about our show and whether the feeling of our guests and the timing of we bring them on is starting to actually be a bit of a market timing element where, you know, we had all the bulls at the dollar top and then we have all the bears potentially at a turning point at the bottom of an extreme U.S. dollar oversold state.
Well, Patrick, I'd like to think that we haven't descended all the way to the point of Macro Voices becoming Time Magazine, but I do understand your point, and I think it's very well made. What I would say to that is I don't see this as now the bottom is in. I know, at least in my own experience, I was looking for the opportunity to buy bottom in the dollar, buy the dip. And I'm really rethinking that because a lot of people that have very informed views have persuaded me to see another side of the argument. I think we're still probably on the leading edge here compared to where a lot of the market is. So I don't know that it's quite the Time Magazine effect, but certainly the idea that the dollar bears had it wrong and it's any day now before the dollar bulls get proven right again, I'm definitely not as attached to that view as I was a few months ago.
Well, you know, one thing that I've picked up this week from the headlines, well, first of all, there was that big headline over the weekend where the PBOC announced that they would remove the reserve requirements for the financial institutions trading in FX forwards by cutting it to zero from its current 20%. And the moment that happened, the renminbi, which was in this shooting uptrend, in fact, if anyone who looked at that chart, there's been parabolic rise almost in the renminbi versus the US dollar. And it's not reflected in the dollar index, but that's really where there's been this extraordinary currency move. And suddenly the renminbi reversed over the weekend. And then you see that already in the euro, it's faded the Mario Draghi pop from last week as well. You're seeing a very strong reversal in the US dollar yen. And so you're getting a lot of these kind of reversal points that just happened in the last week. What's also interesting is there was that in the research roundup email, we put a link to this variant perception blog that came out where they're talking about the US dollar being very stretched to the downside. And a lot of the points that they made was they were looking at the divergence of the dollar from its 200-day moving average. And they also commented on the commitment of trader report positioning, where now the number of US dollar bears is at multi-year high levels, approaching the 2014 levels. And so we have all these guests coming on as bears, but we are sort of at this period where the big US dollar downdraft probably is already rearview mirror. I mean, there could be more on the decline, but I think that we're bringing to light the obvious. Now, Eric, moving on, what was really amazing was that story that just came out with comments from Jamie Dimon talking about Bitcoins. And it was just amazing to hear him use such extreme language saying that, you know, Bitcoin is a fraud. It's worse than the tulip bubbles, and going on to say it's going to blow up and he would fire any trader trading Bitcoin for being stupid. What's your take on his comments?
I couldn't believe it that he said these things. And, you know, it blows my mind because, first of all, I listen. Listeners, no, I am no big fan of Bitcoin either. I don't think it's viable. But for crying out loud, he would fire somebody for being stupid for trading Bitcoin in any way. So that includes being short if you don't think it's viable. It blows my mind that he said that. And this is the guy who didn't fire anybody after they lost $9 billion on a so-called hedge, which was basically a workaround to the Volcker rule when they were operating an illegal prop desk. So it blows my mind. But I I also think to call it a fraud is ridiculous. It's not a fraud. It's something that is likely to be outlawed because it threatens the ability of governments to have what I consider to be overreach. People other than me might say it's necessary for the common good ability to control our financial lives. So Bitcoin is definitely not a fraud. That is ludicrous. And I just wonder what this guy is smoking, frankly, when he says something like that. In any case, we are out of time for today's show. You know, folks, you've heard it before, we really need your help. If you want us to continue bringing these really fantastic guests like Hugh Hendry today, we need your help promoting the show. So please forward our research roundups, retweet us when we announce the show, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best featured interview guests. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find each and every week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for this week's interview with Hugh Hendry. You're also going to find a link to the Variant Perception blog I referenced about the dollar being very stretched to the downside. You'll also find an article written by Chris Whalen discussing Goldman Sachs and the Volcker Rule. There was also a link to Kevin Muir's Macro Tourist, where he puts into context the Bank of International Settlements working paper on how demographics will reverse three multi-decade trends. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.